Tonight we're on chapter 29, which covers the fifth commandment, promote the culture of life. And you know, each chapter of the book, the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults, begins with a biography of someone, whether it's a saint or some other historical figure in the church, in the life of the church, and also some very contemporaneous people in the life of the church. The one introducing this chapter is Dorothy Day. And I just want to talk a little, few moments about Dorothy Day, because she is, there's no more fitting person to illustrate the issues of this chapter than Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day is a woman who is on the path to being named a saint. She Cardinal O'Connor, when he was still living, he was the one that actually began that process. He was the Cardinal of New York City, and New York is where her ministry, her life was formed. She exemplifies the struggles and the difficulties of the 20th century in a very unique way. Dorothy grew up as an atheist. She became very involved in the early socialist and communist movements in the early part of the 20th century. Have you ever seen the movie Reds, which was directed by Warren Beatty? It tells a story of the kind of the communist parties that was forming back in the, like in the 20s or so. And Dorothy is never portrayed in that movie, but that's the circle that she hung out with. That's the circle that she was with, John Reed and the others that were there, and including just went completely blank on his name, the playwright. I'll come up with it, all right, from that era that she was personally involved with. She ends up having getting pregnant. She ends up having an abortion. And she goes through, after that, a conversion where she comes to the Catholic faith and where then she brings some of the same sentiments of concern for the poor and working for justice and peace. She brings that to her Catholic faith, and she begins to see those dimensions of the gospel that in some ways were very clearly being neglected. She, along with a man named Peter Maurin, will found what is known as the Catholic Worker Movement. Beginning in New York City with working with the poor there and again working with the poor, but also working for peace and justice. She will go to jail many times because of protesting on behalf of peace, on behalf of justice, on behalf of life. And there's a passage here. We have at the beginning here some reflections which come from Cardinal O'Connor. And and this is on page 388. Where he says, "I wish every woman who has suffered an abortion would come to know Dorothy Day. Her story was so typical. Made pregnant by a man who insisted she have an abortion, who then abandoned her anyway. She suffered terribly for what she had done, and later pleaded with others not to do the same. But later too, after becoming a Catholic, she learned the love and mercy of the Lord, and knew she never had to worry about his forgiveness. This is why I have never condemned a woman who has had an abortion. I weep with her and ask her to remember Dorothy Day's sorrow, but to know always God's loving mercy and forgiveness. Not everyone who knew Dorothy at a distance is aware of her meetings with Mother Teresa of Calcutta or of the esteem in which Mother Teresa held her. A new book by Jim Forrest, Love is the Measure, includes a portion of a Mother Teresa letter written for Dorothy Day's 75th birthday. Mother Teresa wrote to her, so much love, so much sacrifice, all for him alone. You have been such a beautiful branch on the vine, Jesus, and allowed his father, the vine dresser, to prune you so often and so much. You have accepted all with great love. Because of her abortion and her repentance, because of her work for justice and her work for peace, I think the bishops could not have found a better person in the 20th century to exemplify this particular chapter. I really do hope and pray that she will become a saint of the church, because I think she will really speak to our generation, to our age, of a dimension of the gospel, which is that of working for justice and peace, which is often not taken seriously today, which is often seen as somehow, you know, we have a tendency, I think, as a culture, and then we as a church, to fall into this terrible trap of thinking of ourselves as liberals and conservatives and lefts and rights, all right? If you really read the Gospels and if you read the church's teaching, you're not going to be comfortable in any of those camps. All right? You're not going to be comfortable as a conservative at times. You're not going to be comfortable as a liberal at times. You are going to be challenged on all levels at that time. Our job is not to be conservative. Our job is not to be liberal. Our job is to be people of the gospel. All right? And that will critique all sides of the political spectrum from time to time. And so as she really, again, I really hope that we will learn from Dorothy. Let's get into this. There's a lot that we need to cover tonight. And I'm going to be looking at the book a lot, so if you want to keep your book close to you. Thou shalt not kill. When we began a few weeks ago talking about the basic moral principles that underlie all Catholic moral theology, I began by saying that the most basic of the moral principles is the dignity of the human person. If we don't get this, we will not get Catholic moral teaching. The dignity of the human person. The dignity is far beyond what makes sense to us even. Every human being, from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death, is of infinite value to God. Because that human life was created in the image and the likeness of God and is, in fact, a son or daughter of God. Now, certainly we as Catholics recognize that very clearly when we're talking about abortion, that the unborn child is a child of God. It is a human being whose life has great value and dignity. We also see this at the end of life. As we look at those end of life issues, that we cannot treat the elderly as if they are a burden, as if they are just a difficulty. This is a child of God. This is a beloved child of God, created in God's own image and likeness, and who needs to be treated with great respect and dignity. Where we sometimes, I think as Catholics, struggle is with all those people in between who are not innocent. Because the same things that we say about the unborn and the same thing we say about the elderly is also true of the prisoner, of the criminal, of the terrorist, of the murderer, of the abortion doctor, of the person, the woman who has the abortion. It's not only innocent human life that is precious to God, but it's also guilty human life that is precious to God. That murderer, that terrorist, is a son or a daughter of God. That's what God sees first and foremost when he looks at Osama bin Laden. He doesn't see the terrorist first. He sees his son, Osama. When he looks at anyone in our world who is on death row, he does not see first and foremost a murderer and a prisoner. He sees his son or his daughter, who is also a murderer and a prisoner, and that person is infinitely valuable to God. And what is infinitely valuable to God cannot be without value to you and me, who are the Church of God. We are to put on the heart and the mind of Christ. And Christ came for sinners. He came for the guilty, not the innocent. He did not come to save the righteous. He came to save those who were lost. And so we, as Catholics, have to learn to move beyond kind of the limitations that are kind of natural to us as human beings and those that we pick up from the culture that we live in and recognize that all human life is infinitely sacred and holy because it is created by God and it is loved by God, each and every human being. We see very early in the scriptures, right after the expulsion from the garden and the stories of in Genesis, we see the story of Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel, of course, being the sons of Adam and Eve, Cain ends up killing his brother Abel, the first murder. And then when God comes and asks Cain about his brother, Cain asks a very important question. Am I my brother's keeper? And obviously, Cain is trying to imply that I'm not. But God's response is clearly, you are. We are our brother's keeper. We are responsible for the lives of those around us, of our brothers and sisters in this world, and for all of them. So it's not simply about how do I protect and reverence my own life or even that of my family around me, but of all people, especially those whose lives are treated with the least amount of respect of all. If you have your book with you, look on page 389. There's a quote here, our section of the book that I think was really important, and it says it better than I can, so I want us to read through that, where it talks about respecting human life. And then, God's creative action is present to every human life and is thus the source of its sacred value. God created it, that's why it's sacred. Every human life remains in a relationship with God, who is the final goal of every man and woman. The fifth commandment calls us to foster the physical, spiritual, emotional, and social well-being of self and others. Right? The fifth commandment calls us to foster the physical, spiritual, emotional, and social well-being of self and others. The fifth commandment, it's not enough to simply say, I didn't kill anybody. We are called to go beyond that and to foster life, to protect life, to support life. And so to foster the physical, spiritual, emotional, and social well-being of ourselves and others. For that reason, it forbids murder, abortion, euthanasia, and any life-threatening acts. We are called to create the culture of life and work against the culture of death. This presents us with three challenges. One, we need to counter the relativism that imperils human life. By recognizing that human freedom needs to be consistent with God's intentions and the laws that govern moral life. We've spoken many times about this moral relativism that Pope Benedict XVI continues to say over and over and over is the great threat to the gospel in our time. The relativism that says there is no such thing as right and wrong. There is no such thing as what is true in terms of an objective truth. You have your truth, I have my truth. Okay, you know, you may think abortion is wrong. That's fine. Don't have one. But I think abortion is perfectly okay, so don't get in my way. You don't have any right to try to stop me, right? Because there's no such thing as right and wrong. There's only your right and wrong, and there's my right and wrong, and mine is decidedly different than yours. This is moral relativism. There is no objective truth that is out there, and certainly no objective truth that comes to us from God, to which I have a moral responsibility to conform my life and my will. But that is precisely what we believe. And so unless we address that issue, we will never be successful. We will never be successful at stopping the destruction of human life, the devaluing of human life that we see going on. The central issue is this relativism that says there is no such thing as absolute truth, as objective truth. Two, we must witness God's providential presence to all creation, and particularly to each human being. We need to help the world to see that God is real. Now, there's a quote here from Pope John Paul II. Where God is denied and people live as though he did not exist or his commandments are not taken into account, the dignity of the human person and the inviolability of human life also end up being rejected or compromised. Where God is rejected, the dignity of human life is rejected. Where God is not acknowledged and honored, human life is not acknowledged and honored as having infinite value. Where God is denied, so what do we have to do? We have to witness. It's not simply enough to say they ought to be converted. We are the witnesses of God. We must witness God's providential presence. Three, we need to confront the weakening of conscience in modern society. Too many people fail to distinguish between good and evil when just dealing with the value of human life. Moral confusion leads many to support choices and policies that desecrate life. Choices that were once considered criminal and immoral have become socially acceptable. Many consciences that were once formed by the Ten Commandments, Christ's moral teachings, and the Holy Spirit's grace-filled guidance are now swayed by the moral confusion of the spirit of our times. We should deal with the weakening of conscience by helping people to understand the church's teaching on conscience as the capacity to make judgments in agreement with God's law, to protect human dignity and reject anything that degrades it. People today think that following my conscience means I get to do what I want to do. Whereas the Catholic Church's teaching on the following of conscience is that I am seeking the freedom to live according to God's will and God's plan. That's genuine conscience, and that's genuine freedom. And again, these three challenges, so it's not simply that we're going to attack abortion or these other issues legally, all right? That's a beginning, but it certainly is not an end, all right? And I'm going to address in a little bit, especially when we get into the whole abortion issue. So let's get into talking about some of the life issues that confront us. A, murder. The first one is murder. Murder is the deliberate killing of an innocent person, and it is always forbidden. There are no circumstances whatsoever where I can deliberately kill an innocent person, where I purposely kill an innocent person. It is never, ever, under any circumstances, morally permissible. All right. In the Ten Commandments, the commandment says, "Thou shalt not kill." That really is not an accurate translation. The accurate translation of that commandment really is, "Thou shalt not commit murder," because side by side with the Ten Commandments and "Thou shalt not kill" are places where the scriptures do speak of killing in war and killing in self-defense and other ways that are morally justified. So the real translation there is "Thou shalt not commit murder," the deliberate killing of an innocent person. But the church does allow and says that morally self-defense can be justified. If somebody is seeking to kill me, and the only way in which I can defend myself is by taking their life, then I have a right to do that. And not only if they're attacking me, but if they're attacking someone else who needs my support. If I'm a husband or a father and someone is attacking my family and I have to kill this person in order to protect them, then I have a moral right to do that. All right? If we go to war in order to defend someone, a smaller country that cannot defend itself, then that can be morally justified. Now, we're going to have just war later on. But that self-defense is the defense of others, then it is permissible to kill. But only then. If there is not an element of self-defense that is there, it is absolutely forbidden. Let's talk about abortion. Abortion has always been forbidden by the church, contrary to Nancy Pelosi, who tried to say that there has been question about this. There has never been question about this. The earliest non-biblical document that we have from the church is called the Didache, and is a containing of the teaching of the apostles. It is first century. Like in the 90s, so it's immediately after the time of the apostles themselves, and it absolutely forbids abortion. Abortion has never been considered morally acceptable by the church, and it has the question of whether or not abortion should be acceptable has never been seriously debated. What has been debated were when does the fetus actually possess a soul. And there has been difference in theologians. When does that happen? And even St. Thomas Aquinas says something about around 90 days or something like that, and I don't know what his rationale was for that. But even those who argue that the soul does not enter into the fetus immediately, but sometimes later, have never argued that it is okay to kill that fetus up until that time. There has never, ever been a time in Catholic moral theology where abortion was ever considered morally acceptable. Okay? Can you get clear on that, right? It cannot and it will not change. This teaching cannot and will not change. Anybody who is waiting for the Catholic Church to change its teaching on abortion is a fool. It is not going to happen. You know, we have groups like Catholics for free choice or something like that, which is actually made up mostly of non-Catholics and is made up of fallen away Catholics. But if they think the church, that they are going to impact the church in terms of making a decision of changing its teaching, it's not going to happen. It is not going to happen, and it cannot happen. There's a quote on page 391 from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. From its conception, the child has the right to life. Direct abortion, that is, abortion willed as an end or as a means, is a criminal practice gravely contrary to the moral law. The Church imposes the canonical penalty of excommunication for this crime against human life. Because it should be treated as a person from conception, the embryo must be defended in its integrity, cared for, and healed like every other human being. That child, in the mother's womb, from the moment of conception, has the same rights to being treated with great dignity and respect and to be protected as any other human being. Let me just address that one point there where the Church imposes the canonical penalty of excommunication for this crime against human life. What does this mean? Does that mean that every woman who's ever had an abortion is excommunicated? No. No, it does not mean that. First of all, in order to incur the penalty of excommunication, you have to know that you are actually committing a sin that has that penalty attached to it. Now, if I know that the Church has attached that penalty of excommunication and I have an abortion or I perform an abortion, then yes, I am excommunicated because I have known about that penalty and I did the action anyway. Now, can somebody who has been excommunicated be forgiven? Absolutely. How do you do it? You go to confession like every other sin. All right? You go to confession and that excommunication is lifted. Excommunication essentially says that you have done something so serious that you have done it with full knowledge of what you are doing, that you are no longer considered truly one of us. You have stepped outside. You have stepped outside the community, the church, by this action. Now, how many Catholics, what percentage of Catholics have abortions? All right, now I gave you some information there. There's a handout that was there for when you came in. All right, and so just some abortion facts. I just happened to come across this morning as I was doing some, just kind of looking around for some, to try to get some statistics, and I found this, the Center for Bioethical Reform, which I had not had any personal encounter with before, but I just really liked these particular abortion facts. I was shocked. I knew the number was big. I had no idea. I had no idea that the number of abortions worldwide per year is approximately 42 million each year. 42 million children are aborted in our world. That's 115,000 per day. If you get down below the number of abortions per year in the United States, 1.37 million. All right, that was in 1996. That was when those statistics were taken. It's approximately 3,700. Then it goes down. There's some great information. I'm not going to go through all of this that I found very interesting, but and you might too. Who's having abortions in terms of age, in terms of race, marital status? Who's having abortions in terms of a religion? Women identifying themselves as Protestants obtain about 37.4% of all abortions in the United States. Catholic women account for 31.3%. Statistically insignificant. Right, it is there. It's equivalent. Jewish women account for 1.3%, and women with no religious affiliation obtain 23.7% of all abortions. 18% of all abortions are performed on women who identify themselves as born-again evangelical. There's some other information that you might want to look at. That was the primary thing. Now, here's what I had learned. I was under the impression for a long time that the percentage of women in our culture, who are of childbearing age, you know, since Roe versus Wade, which now is almost every woman, now even the elderly were actually would be included in that category when they were younger, it was about 20%, the one out of every five. I later came across, just within the last year or two, I came across information that said it's actually 30% or 33%, or one third. All right. Now, I was stunned by that, and I thought, that can't be true. That can't be true. That one third, you know, again, just on Sunday, looking around at here at IHM, where we might have 600 people here. All right. Well, let's say that let's take that down in terms of just the adults that are here that we're dealing. Let's say we're dealing with 300. Let's just use that as a round number. 300. What that means is that 100 of the people that are of the adults, one third, have either had an abortion or have been involved in abortion. All right, one third. That's a shocking number. I questioned that, and so I began kind of doing my own kind of anecdotal study. And I did this with penance services, especially focusing on when I have been involved with Crucio weekends and when I've been involved in Christ Renews His Parish weekends. You're dealing here with, at this point, with some of the most actively Catholic people in our community, all right, men and women. And I had heard that it was about one third, and so I began keeping track. And now, what I always do when I'm on those involved in those weekends is I talk about abortion. I talk about the fact that there are a lot of us in this room who have had abortion, have been involved in abortion, and I encourage them, please come and experience the mercy of the Lord. Guess what I found out? It's at least 30%, and sometimes it's higher. I've had up to 40% of those who are coming to confession to me who are confessing that they have had abortions. All right, we are not talking about them. We are talking about us. We are talking about your daughters and your sons. We are talking about perhaps some of you, undoubtedly some of you that are in this room. We are talking about our friends. We are talking about our neighbors. We need to be very careful when we start thinking that it is us against them. It is not. Them is us. We are as much influenced and impacted by this reality as anybody else. Now, again, I do not condemn, as Cardinal O'Connor said, I do not condemn women who have had abortions or the men that were involved. I believe firmly that in every abortion there is at least two victims, and usually more. There is a child, and there is a woman, and often, too, there is also a man. All three of whom are affected. The baby dies, but the man and the woman live with deep emotional and spiritual wounds for the rest of their lives. For the rest of their lives. And I've dealt with many of these people. So, you know, as we talk about this, we don't do it with a self-righteousness. We can't. We have to understand that, again, it's not us against them. This is about us. This is about us, and that's where it begins. So, where do we go with all this? Where do we go with all this? Many people believe, I think mistakenly,